everyone. Welcome back to the Breast Cancer Podcast. Hello, I'm your host, Dr. Deepa Halaharvi, a fellowship-trained breast surgeon, and also happen to be a breast cancer survivor, thriver, and a warrior living my best life. As you know, breast cancer affects millions worldwide, touching lives in a profound ways. Whether you're someone facing a diagnosis, or a supporter seeking information, or just eager to learn more, this podcast aims to be a beacon of understanding, hope, and empowerment. I'm here to talk about all things breast cancer, from surgery to survivorship, as well as high risk for breast cancer to metastatic breast cancer. My goal is to provide you with reliable information, share inspiring narratives, and foster a supportive community. I know firsthand the challenges breast cancer diagnosis brings. Throughout this podcast, I will give you strategies to handle difficulties that arise from cancer diagnosis. We'll have insightful conversations with medical experts, researchers, survivors, caregivers, and advocates. I will tackle topics that impact our lives as cancer survivors. My goal is to educate you and empower you to live your best life. I definitely have. Well, let's get started. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Breast Cancer Podcast. I have Dr. Jovita Orwari. Did I say your name correct?
Perfect.
Okay. All right. It's a beautiful name. It's a beautiful name. Thank from you. St. Louis. And I just kind of want you to introduce yourself, Dr. Orwari.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on, first of all. It's great that you do this podcast and get information out there to the patients. Like you said, I'm Jovita Orwari. I'm a breast surgeon. I'm located in St. Louis, Missouri, work for a hospital. And I have been doing this for over 20 years. I was one of the first group of fellows that they graduated. Actually, the first group of fellows that were graduated. So I've been doing this for a long time, and I love what I do. I love talking to women and helping them get to a better place.
Yeah. Well, that's very obvious with all your postings and your presence on social media. And I got to meet Dr. Orwari at a recent American Society of Breast Surgeon conference last week in Orlando. And I thought that was a phenomenal conference. And, you know, I got to meet you and several other like-minded people. So yeah. I was super excited to, you know, see you in person. I've seen you, you know, posting on social media and the information you give out to everyone. And I thought it's always so inspiring. And I don't know, and I was talking to you right before we got started. I'm not sure if this type of platform exists for the community where we as breast surgeons bring information back from these conferences for just lay people to understand what's, you know, updated information on breast cancer treatment. And so we were there for 3 days in Orlando, and if you want to go ahead and get started, you can, and you can give a couple of pearls. I can give a couple of pearls, and we can keep going. And
okay.
I'll let you take it from
okay.
here.
Okay, I will start. I jotted a few things down that I wanted to make sure that that I talked about. And when I go to these meetings and when I come back, the most important thing for me or to me is to think, what can I on Monday morning realistically implement? You know, a lot of it we can't, but some of it we actually can.
Yes.
So for me, lifestyle and breast cancer has just always been so interesting to me and important to me. So I do post a lot about healthy eating and exercising and all of that. So the part of the conference, we talked about lifestyle and breast cancer and the data that I was presented about just the things that I talk about every day, just that blew my mind because on Monday morning, I was like, oh my God, I can't say that anymore.
Yes.
So what was that? That the big information was that BMI,
yeah,
diet, and alcohol were not as important as we used to think it was.
Yeah. I was very surprised with that.
I was super surprised.
Yeah.
Because the big thing now is telling our patients to stop smoking, which we do anyway.
Yes.
Because it increases the risk for breast cancer recurrence. And exercise, which I'm happy about that exercise is still
yes.
in play.
Yes, yes.
Because I'm, you know, very committed to exercising myself and having my patients exercise. So
yes.
That was the biggest takeaway for me from the conference.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you know, what about you?
Yeah, same. I was also thinking the same thing. And, you know, I'm a breast cancer survivor and, you know, I don't drink a lot, but at social gatherings, I will have a drink or two. And I was kind of relieved to know it's okay to, you know, have a drink here and there and not to have excessive drinking, which I knew that before, but it kind of made me feel a little bit better. Like, okay, I'm okay to drink just in moderation with anything, right? In life.
Exactly. With anything.
With anything in moderation. Yes.
And like I tell my patients now that I've kind of changed the way I talk about this, you know, I tell them that, yes, as far as breast cancer recurrence, maybe, you know, the Mediterranean diet and plant-based that we stressed all the time, maybe it's not as important, but it is still important for overall health.
Yes, yes.
Especially heart health, which is the number one killer of women in the United States. So
yes, yes,
we have to be mindful of, you know, how to use the data.
Yeah, you know, heart disease, and I always say it's not the cancer that's going to kill you, assuming you're getting proper, appropriate treatment by a physician, but, you know, taking care of your, you know, if you're diabetic, making sure your sugars are under control, your weight is under control, eating healthy, exercising regularly. And for us women, I love what you do on social media. You post pictures on Mondays where you're exercising, lifting weights. I love lifting weights, and I see you doing that. And that's so important for women, especially women with breast cancer who are taking anti-estrogen medications can, you know, aromatase inhibitors can cause, you know, osteopenia, osteoporosis. And lifting is so important for women. And I talk about that all the time, in addition to, like, you know, some cardiac activity in the week. And how often do you exercise in a week?
My goal is to do it every single day.
Yeah.
So that if I miss a day or two, then I don't feel that bad.
Yeah.
So that's my goal.
Yeah. You know, I just recently had my mom move in with me. She's having some issues with diabetes and heart disease, things like that. And my new saying is health is wealth, you know.
It truly is.
Like, I mean, you can have millions of dollars, but if you don't have health, you really don't have much. So that's going to be my new saying from here on.
Yes, it is.
So I was going to go back to the first day of the conference where they talked about MRI and, you know, our MRI is overutilized in treating breast cancer. And what was your take-home message from that lecture?
I know it's been a controversial topic for as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
MRIs, should we be doing them? Are we overdoing them?
Yeah.
And I really personally, regardless of the data, I believe that MRIs are important in breast cancer treatment. And right now in my practice, I do get them pretty much for maybe 90% of women who have breast cancer. Every once in a while, you have someone who's not a good candidate for an MRI, either because they have a pacemaker or they're claustrophobic, whatever it is. But I think between myself and our radiologists, it's part of our toolbox of things to do. Because, I mean, it just takes finding one or two cancers that the mammogram or the ultrasound didn't pick up for you to become a believer. So I am a believer in MRIs.
Yeah. No, I think I do agree with you. You know, I'm sure you're diagnosing younger and younger women these days.
Absolutely.
And these women tend to have dense breast tissue. Sometimes the cancer can hide behind the dense breast tissue. So it's absolutely necessary. I think those in younger women, they say lobular cancer is a sneaky cancer. Women with Paget's disease, where the cancer can start on the nipple, and with cancer in the lymph nodes. You know, women with ruptured implants or having cancer in multiple areas of the breast. It does lead to a little bit additional biopsies, as we know the literature has shown. As long as we prepare our, you know, patients that, you know, you probably will be getting a call from me telling you you need additional biopsies. I think it's a really great tool that we have in our toolbox, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. And the thing is, a lot of patients are actually pretty savvy.
Yeah.
And they do a lot of research. And I would have patients say, well, are you going to do an MRI? And at that point, they almost force your hand to do one because, God forbid, they're the ones that you didn't do an MRI on. And then there was something there that the mammogram or the ultrasound had missed. So, you know, for now, I am still doing it. Again, semi-selectively.
Yeah, yeah. I typically am selective in like older people who are afraid, you know, have a lot of anxiety and may not change a whole lot of management, things like that. So
true.
I was also happy to see how much they focus on oncoplastic surgery performed by breast surgeons. And do you perform a lot of oncoplastic surgery in your practice?
I don't do a lot of it because I have plastic surgeons that I work closely with, but I do some. And, you know, I think the appearance of the breast after breast surgery, whether it's a lumpectomy or a mastectomy, is so important. Like I tell my patients, the primary goal is to get the cancer, but the secondary goal is for you to look good afterwards and for you to be happy with what you see in the mirror, because you don't want that daily reminder that you've been through this.
Yes.
So the least we can do is make you at least happy to look at yourself in the mirror.
Yeah.
So I believe in oncoplastics, and I was happy to see that we're moving forward with the certification.
Yeah.
Which, you know, now I have to become more more conscious about taking pictures and recording what I've done.
Yeah.
So that I can become certified, and it just will really kind of separate the good breast surgeons from the, maybe the general surgeons that are doing breast surgeries. That's, I think it's really important that we move forward with that as a society.
No, I agree. I 100% agree. And I think that's why I think it's so important to keep going to this conference, as there's all updates and nuances that are there. And, you know, as a breast surgeon, we are the first responders to this woman who's diagnosed with breast cancer. And I always, you know, tell patients, okay, I'm captain of your ship. It's so funny. Some of my patients call me captain, and I love that. Yeah. and so, I mean, I agree with you. I do think our desire to remove cancer, make them cancer-free, is super high, but then our desire to make them look cosmetically pleasing and hoping that they will never remember they had cancer by hiding the infection and doing good surgery and working with a good plastic surgery team. The relationship between plastic surgeon and breast surgeon is so, I think, important. And
that is so important. That's important. And, you know, also the thing about oncoplastics, which I find the general surgeons, the reasons they don't like to do it is because it's time consuming. It's,
Yeah.
It takes so much time, the thinking, the planning, the length of surgery.
Yeah.
I mean, nipple sparing mastectomies are some of the hardest cases that we do.
Those are so tough. Yes.
Yeah. But it's all worth it in the end.
It is worth it. Yes. Yes, absolutely. It is worth it. It takes a lot of time. I will say general surgeons have so many things that they need to worry about. The you know, appendectomies, gallbladder surgeries, bowel surgeries, you know, pancreas and adrenal glands and thyroid. I think it's a lot to ask one person to be, you know, to know so many things. And so for us, we have the advantage. We're just focused on
We're so focused.
And so, you know, someone who's fellowship trained breast surgeon definitely, I think, offers, you know, different toolbox than someone who doesn't do breast on a regular basis. I do know general surgeons who do breast only do a phenomenal job. So
Well, yes. I have to say that. Yes.
Yeah.
When I say general surgeon, I mean the general surgeons that are doing everything else.
Yes. Yeah. So there was another topic that talked about implant-associated lymphoma, from the breast implants, and they talk about textured implants being macro-textured implants. And in 2019, FDA said if you're not having any symptoms, you don't need to remove them. But if you're having symptoms like fluid buildup and mass, you know, things like that, you know, enlarged lymph nodes, then you want to be worked up by your physician. But I don't think plastic surgeons place those type of implants anymore. Do you agree?
No. I agree with you. I've probably seen, I think I've only seen one in practice.
Yes. There's only, 430 cases in the United States up until now. So it's not a very common thing. But patients do ask about it though, right?
Of course. And it's normal to have that concern. And the patients that ask about it are not only breast cancer patients, the patients who just had a plain old implant. That are worried about it. So, and I'm glad that there's so few of them, and I'm glad that the plastic surgeons are not placing them anymore.
Yeah.
And for the most part, when I'm asked about implants, I tell them that it's very much safe. You know, it's safe to do it, and I have no qualms about making that recommendation. Yes. My patients.
Yes, I 100% agree. I thought one of the big take-home messages was genetic testing. Like they said, almost everyone should get genetic testing. What do you think of that?
I was going to ask you what you thought about that.
Yeah. No, because, I actually. Whoa. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I will say,
because population testing. Wow.
Yeah. As long as we are educating people, I mean, obviously we work with breast cancer patients a lot, and I think counseling them appropriately, you know, on, you know, what is genetic testing? What information does that give you? And I will say it's really important for following them in the future, not just with mammograms, MRIs, and, you know,
that's true.
You know, seeing a lot of clinicians, you know, two clinicians a year if they're considered high risk. There is definitely a place for that. What do you think of that?
No, I think there's definitely a place for that. Should every single woman get genetic tested? I don't know that we need to go that far yet.
Yeah.
But since I've started doing high-risk screening, which is a whole other topic, we've been doing a whole lot of genetic testing. And I think it's important for it to be for it to be there, available to women that actually do need it. But another thing that I do stress to my patients who get genetic testing is I don't want you to do genetic testing just because it's there and it's available, but I want you to also think about the implications of that test when it comes back positive. Right. Are you willing to take that next step?
Yeah.
If we recommend bilateral prophylactic mastectomy, is that something you're willing to start thinking about?
Yeah.
Bilateral sapping oophorectomy, removing your ovaries, all of that. And I typically, I don't know if that's your practice, I typically don't recommend genetic testing in women under 25.
Yeah.
Just because I don't think that they are equipped to think about the implications of a positive test or to even want to start making those decisions.
Yeah.
That young.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I also don't think or at least as of right now, I wouldn't recommend to everyone, all the population, but there are, you know, patients who get diagnosed with cancer, have family history of breast cancer, triple negative breast cancer, high risk breast cancer. And I will say family history of ovarian cancer, that subset definitely will benefit because it helps us to use like PARP inhibitors if they're BRCA positive with the breast cancer diagnosis. Platinum-based therapy if they're triple negative, so on and so forth. But I agree with you. I think it should be very a shared decision-making with the patients, making sure they understand what it means to get have genetic testing. Like, again, you know, knowledge is power, knowing what is genetic.
Knowledge is power.
Knowing what is variant of unknown significance, you know, meaning like they don't really have a mutation, but then, you know, is that going to cause anxiety? Are they going to be awake at night thinking about it? So I definitely think knowledge, just educating yourself, I think it's important.
For sure. I agree. In that vein, they also talked about high-risk screening.
Yes,
that it should be done for everyone. I agree with that.
Yes.
And that's another thing that I changed on Monday morning because I was typically screening the women that, you know, had family histories or that I thought would fit into the high-risk criteria, dense breast, et cetera. But I think we should be screening everyone.
Yeah, we should be. So it's you're talking about the breast cancer risk assessment is what
the risk assessment.
About.
I'm sorry. Yes. Breast cancer risk assessment. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, for our listeners, you know, what that is it's if some, you know, someone comes in, of course, you're saying you do that on every patient. I think that's a really phenomenal, great idea because you really don't know until you plug these numbers into the computerized model to see if they're considered high risk. And, you know, depending on their age, their density of the breast, the family history, when they had their first child, how many kids, if they have any, had not kids, all those things get plugged into this computerized models. There's different models. What's your model that you like to use? Do you use?
I like the Tyrer-Cuzick.
Yes,
same. The version 8. Yeah.
Yes, I use the Tyrer-Cuzick as well.
I used to use the Gale years ago, and I haven't used it recently. And, you know, from the meetings, they have their pluses and minuses, but right now I'm using the Tyrer-Cuzick exclusively.
Yeah, I use Tyrer-Cuzick exclusively as well. And it really educates women, you know, talking mm-hmm. to them about self breast exams, following closely, not just
right.
you know, age 25, they don't qualify for any sort of imaging unless they have a genetic, you know, mutation right. like BRCA exactly. or BRCA, then they start MRIs and then every right. and then mammogram starting at age 30. So it makes, you know, Olivia Munn, actress who came out recently that she had family history of breast cancer mm-hmm. and she was diagnosed with breast cancer based on this high-risk breast cancer assessment yeah. model, and then where her cancer was found on a breast MRI. And I just diagnosed a patient last week who was diagnosed yeah. on a breast MRI. The mammogram did same. Not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there are quite a few women like that,
yes.
and women
yes.
who wouldn't ordinarily know that they fit into that category where they should be getting MRIs.
Yes. Yeah,
and the risk assessment helps with that.
Oh, 100%. And especially for yes. women, there's no recommendations for screening if you're younger than 40. And I think breast cancer
exactly.
assessment works really well, mm-hmm. especially given that you're diagnosing so many young women with breast cancer. So
exactly.
yeah, I'm yeah. so glad you're doing that and I'm doing that. And again, you know, education, knowledge is power. So, you know.
Yep, knowledge is power.
Yes.
Yep.
What are some other things that you want to share?
We talked a lot about disparities.
Yes,
right?
That's a topic of my passion, actually.
Yeah,
so.
And,
yeah,
and mine as well. You know, you and I being from
yes.
third world countries.
Yes, yes.
And being in, marginalized populations. And I
yes.
think it's really important to be aware of these disparities. I went back, I was looking at the slides, and I was looking at time spent by physicians talking to patients about breast cancer. You know, Caucasian women, I think the number was almost 60 minutes time spent discussing
yeah.
their breast cancer. And for African-American women, it was about 30 to 40 minutes. I'm like, why are we spending less time?
Yeah.
We're not giving the same information.
Yeah.
My cancer talks are the same for every
yes.
single patient.
Right,
I don't shorten
right.
it for particular groups of
yeah.
patients. So I thought that was really concerning looking at those numbers. And of course, the numbers as far as survival and mortality rates in African-American women compared to Caucasian women is 40% higher.
That just baffles my mind.
Urban. Yeah.
That just baffles my mind every time I see that number. 40%
yeah.
higher risk of dying
mm-hmm.
if you're African-American
yeah.
woman as opposed to a Caucasian woman.
Yes.
You know, I'm from India. Cancer in South Asia is being diagnosed more at later stages because women don't have screening guidelines there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
And there is a taboo talking about breast cancer or anything relating to breast, you know.
Yeah.
I remember when I was diagnosed with cancer, I was invited to go on a Today Show with Hoda Kotb. And I told that to my mom and I was thinking my mom would be super excited. And she's like, you're going to go on national TV and tell people that you have breast cancer. I'm like, yeah, I am. And she's like,
yeah.
I'm like, mom, I didn't rob a bank. You know, I have cancer. I want to educate
right.
people. So
right.
it's, you know, it's a type of our culture, you know, at least Indian culture, they don't
mm-hmm.
talk about these things in family gatherings.
Right.
And, you know, your breast cancer risk assessment you're talking about, it's important to know your family history. And I think for us women,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter what our ethnic background is, it's important to talk about family history of cancers in general, you know.
Absolutely.
And that
Absolutely.
Way you can talk to your doctor because that can impact in type of, you know, treatment
mm-hmm.
and follow-up one would get.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that 100%.
Yeah. There is also in CDC, a paper came out talking about how women that live in rural areas, lower socioeconomic status, are not getting mammography. Well, you
yeah.
know, it's our job to provide access to care for
access.
These women, you know, who have
mm-hmm.
to work and maybe can't take off from work. Maybe we need to
yeah.
provide like mobile mammography or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sending physicians into rural communities to help educate these women.
Yeah.
You know, those are the things that we really need to work on to decrease the disparities in care.
I agree. All of those things are important. Just, you know, part of my role in the hospital that I work for is as kind of the director of community breast health. So I do a lot of going to churches to talk to
yeah.
women, a lot of
yeah.
that type of thing, because not everybody can make it to the hospital.
Yes.
So you have to go
yes.
reach these women where they are.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know this information.
Yeah.
So a lot of times they're hearing it for the first time. And
yeah.
it's just important to impart the information we have and the importance of mammography and
yeah.
screening. Etc.
Yeah.
And the importance of knowing your family history. and sharing your family history with your relatives, because yeah, you're right. There is kind of a taboo amongst my community as well to talk about these things, but talking about these things can save your life.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, I did the same, and I actually love doing that, talking to, you know, old women in churches and temples and mosques. And because, you know, and again, my podcast came out of that situation where I wanted to provide, you know, access to care. Yeah. But then I think we have to remember, maybe not too many older folks get on the computer or, you know, social media to listen to this. So I'm so glad that you do that. Any other pearls for our listeners?
Let me think. Let me see. What did I do? Oh, they talked a lot about endocrine therapy.
Yes.
And using it prior to surgery. What did you think about that? In an effort to figure out which patients were going to be chemo resistant, et cetera, right?
Yeah. So I actually use that quite often in my patients, in my older patient population. I also, I will also prescribe endocrine therapy, especially for those patients who'll say, I don't want to see one more doctor, or, you know, are coming from far distance and have a hard time seeing doctors. So for my older folks, if I want to shrink down the tumor in the breast, and they're what we call luminal A type of tumor. So those, for our listeners, those are the estrogen progesterone receptor, strongly positive tumors, HER2 negative tumors, those type of patients really do well with the estrogen medication to shrink down the tumor. So I'm a believer in that. How about you?
Yeah, I believe in that, and we use it for our older patients. Yes. But you know, now they're talking about using it for the younger patients as well.
Yeah.
Which I think would be great, especially in African-American women.
Yeah. Yeah,
because that is the population of patients that, even though they have luminal A breast cancers or breast cancers that we think are favorable, actually a good number of them, those cancers are not as favorable as we think.
Yeah.
So if we started with endocrine therapy and we can kind of weed out the people that are responders and the people that are not, a lot of those women are going to end up needing chemo.
Yeah.
Even with small early stage breast cancers.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure you did the same thing during COVID. We couldn't take patients to surgery. Yeah. Ended up starting, you know, patients on endocrine therapy. Yeah. And I had to do that from a young woman too, with like non-invasive cancer called the DCIS. We're just waiting around, not doing anything. So I would just put them on tamoxifen and just kind of monitor them.
Right.
Sometimes though, young women are anxious. They want to get to surgery. They want to get this out. So
they do.
You do have to find.
I know.
But I will say, like you were talking about, young women's type of cancer, I think, is a little bit different than older women's cancer, where it's sometimes very aggressive. And again, you know, in African-American, you know, background, the biology of the tumor is so different.
So different.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason the mortality is high, is they tend to be more triple negative tumors, you know, more high risk, grade 3 tumors.
And there's a lot about breast cancers in African-American women biologically that we just don't even understand yet.
Yes.
And part of it is because the rate of African-American women going into clinical trials is so much less.
Yeah. Yeah.
Than all other populations. And that's something that I would want to plug for in this podcast. So any African-American women who's listening with a breast cancer diagnosis, or know someone with a breast cancer diagnosis, please, 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 you know, sign up for a clinical trial, because that data helps us figure out medicines that we can use to take care of us.
Yeah. No, I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, clinical trials is something that's so important. Yeah. Even like for Indian patients, there are not too many Indians enrolled in clinical trials, or males who are diagnosed with breast cancer, or African Americans, different ethnic background. We just want good distribution of different ethnicities and ages, you know, and both men and women. So that's really great point. Thank you for bringing that up. So I think for our listeners, it's important to find out from their doctors if they have clinical trial for their type of cancer, and to enroll in clinical trials, because, you know, all these studies we talk about, there's, you know, thousands and thousands of women who took part in these trials so they can help other women in the future. So that's one way to leave a legacy, is taking part in this trial, so it helps the women that come after them. You know, that's how I look at it. So
I like that you put in it that way. It is a good legacy to leave.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are so many people that will come behind you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's important. Yeah.
Yeah. These have been really great pearls, Dr. Anything else that you want to say?
I think those are the main things that I think we've covered. We covered genetics and MRI and lifestyle.
Yeah.
We've covered a lot.
Yeah. Well, you are a light, Dr. Owari. You're lighting up this world and making a change in your community and world. And, you know, like, I think sometimes we forget, you know, the difference we make, because I know we are, you know, operating, seeing patients, working 12, 14 hours, tired, going home. But I just want to tell you, on behalf of a breast cancer survivor myself, to see people like you really warms my heart. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And thank you also for everything you do, because seriously, you are a light, and it shines through on Instagram. And I was lucky enough to see it in person the other day. So keep doing what you're doing. You're doing amazing work.
Thank you so much. Thank you again for taking the time to join me today.
Of course.
Have a wonderful, wonderful day. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning into the Breast Cancer Podcast. Remember, you're not alone in this fight. I encourage you to be an active part of this podcast. Please share your stories, questions, and suggestions for future topics at my website called drdeepahalaharvey.com. And please share this podcast with others, especially if you found it useful. And please also give it a 5-star rating, if you will. Stay connected as we navigate the complexities of breast cancer. Until next time, take care and keep shining brightly. Disclaimer: this podcast is not intended for complete medical advice.